This is Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Missouri officials recently announced that a case of a rare virus, probably spread by ticks, had been identified, and they were doing further testing at a state park. The so-called bourbon virus isn't the only one that has made headlines recently. Researchers in the past few years seem to have uncovered increasingly frightening and previously unknown viruses spread by ticks. KCUR's Alex Smith reports.
Amy May says her mother, Tammy Wilson, loved the outdoors and was happy to spend her days working at Merrimack State Park in central Missouri. Her family often stopped by to see her, including a recent visit toward the end of May.
My mom had two seed ticks on her hip, and my sister was there, and my sister pulled them off. A couple days later, Mom said she just wasn't feeling herself.
After a week, after her fatigue and rash worsened, Wilson checked into a hospital in St. Louis. Doctors there were stumped, but Wilson stayed in good spirits and joked with visiting coworkers.
Apparently there's a blue margarita that she liked that all of her and her park friends wouldn't have, and they were telling her, well, as soon as you're better and out of here, we'll go to the Mexican restaurant and get a blue margarita.
But May says at week three, after test results came back from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, her mother was told she had bourbon virus. Before that, there had only been two confirmed cases of the virus, and in one of those, the patient had died. May says her mother started getting nervous.
She didn't really show that too much to me, but I've talked to my brother, and she was telling him that he needs to make sure that his sisters are taken care of and that we're okay, and just kind of leaving him in charge.
A few days later, on June 23rd, Tammy Wilson died. She was 58 years old. The bourbon virus was first discovered in 2014 in a patient who'd been taken to the University of Kansas Hospital. Dr. Dana Hawkinson treated the man, a farmer from Bourbon County, Kansas, whose illness was only identified after he had died.
It was horrible that the patient had that outcome, had died, had passed away, and there was nothing we could have done about it at all. But it was nice to have an answer for the family, at least.
The CDC says it's only seen a few cases since then. And while scientists think the virus is probably spread by ticks, they know almost nothing else about it.
We assume it is other places and in other tick areas. But at this point, there's not a lot to be done. There's no specific treatment for it.
When I was growing up in Kansas City, I got plenty of tick bites on camping trips that were nothing more than a nuisance. But in recent years, ticks seem to be a lot more frightening. Could a walk in the Missouri woods lead to Lyme disease or one of the newly discovered menaces like bourbon or Heartland virus? Brian Allen studies tick viruses at the University of Illinois and says scientists are much better than they used to be at identifying viruses that may have been with us for a long time. But he suspects there's more going on. One of Missouri's most common ticks, for instance, the Lone Star tick, wasn't even considered dangerous until the 1990s.
And so it's really what we think of as an emerging tick, a tick that's causing more problems, more health concerns with time, particularly as we discover new pathogens that seem to be transmitted by it.
Part of the problem is related to climate change. Increasing temperatures have increased the range of mammals that carry ticks, especially white-tailed deer. Fewer natural predators and an increase in foraging areas in the form of crop fields and residential areas have also allowed the populations of deer and other mammals to explode.
They're both important as hosts for the ticks themselves, and so some animals contribute to tick populations, and then some are also important carriers of the pathogens, what we refer to as reservoirs, meaning that these are wildlife that once they get infected with that pathogen, if a tick feeds on them, the tick will actually pick up the pathogen and then be able to transmit it.
Allen says the increase in host populations may be leading to the spread of human viruses that previously affected only animals, and it's possible more new tick viruses may appear.
I think that's what we'll really be excited to see in the next coming decades, is how big is the scope of the problem? Hopefully not much bigger than it is now.
But even if there has been an actual increase in new tick viruses, it doesn't mean people need to spend the rest of their summers hiding indoors. On a scorching afternoon in Merrimack Park, where Tammy Wilson worked, there's still plenty of campers trotting through the woods, even canoeists hanging out in swimsuits. Even though the bourbon virus was linked to this park, health officials say they don't consider it an unusually high-risk area. That's because instead of being an extremely rare and dangerous virus that has so far affected three people, bourbon virus is probably actually a lot more widespread but far less dangerous than what you'd think from reading most newspaper headlines. KU's Dana Hawkinson.
There's probably been quite a bit more cases out there that we just don't know because we weren't able to identify them. And we don't know what the spectrum of disease was. So patients may have very mild disease, maybe just feel, you know, maybe a little ill, and they recover, and so it's not a big deal.
Still, parkgoers might want to rethink spending the day in the Missouri woods wearing only a swimsuit. Health officials advise people heading outdoors to wear long sleeves, use bug spray with DEET, avoid brushy areas, and check for ticks. While the risk of infection may be small, experts say, why take the chance? For KCUR 89.3, I'm Alex Smith.
To hear this story again, visit krcu.org. A Springfield, Missouri couple is working to raise awareness and funding after their four-year-old son was diagnosed with a rare disorder. KSMU's Michelle Skaliski shares her story.
Parker Atchley is your typical preschooler in many ways. He's shy at first, but usually opens up after he gets to know you. He loves anything with wheels, baseball, and splashing in water. And he sticks pretty close to his mom, but a grandma will do if mom's not available. He's an adorable blonde four-year-old with dark-rimmed glasses and a stare that makes you feel like he's thoroughly assessing you, but that also melts your heart. He also is suffering from a rare disease, or at least a disease that only a few have been diagnosed with so far. Sitting on the floor of her living room in southeast Springfield, Parker's mom, Catherine Atchley, says they got a diagnosis in January, KIF 1A-related disorder. It was a long journey to get to that point.
When he was around one, we realized that something was off. We weren't sure. The director of the daycare he was going to actually called a meeting with us to talk about some concerns because he wasn't walking at that point. He had just started traversing around furniture.
His balance was also off. Catherine and her husband Tyler thought maybe it was an ear or eye problem. They took Parker to a pediatrician, an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and a neurologist. All tests came back normal, so they enrolled him in physical therapy. As he got older, they held on to hope that Parker would get better, but he didn't, and they grew more and more frustrated.
It started getting really worrisome when we realized that he was losing skills. Like 2 years ago, he used to be able to stand up on his own, and he can't do that anymore. He was taking 9 steps at a time, and he can't do that anymore.
They took Parker to a second neurologist who recommended genetic testing. They finally got the diagnosis that Catherine said changed everything.
Because then we realized it wasn't just a rare disorder, it was neurodegenerative.
They no longer clung to the hope that Parker was just delayed and that physical therapy could help him catch up. Dr. Wendy Chung, a physician with Columbia University in New York, says KIF 1A-related disorder is a genetic condition that affects the brain and nervous system and is associated with severe disabilities. Those include muscle tightening, spasticity, and difficulty developing. The most disheartening thing about the condition, she says, is that it's degenerative.
That is that children take steps back. They lose abilities. They lose vision.
The first piece of advice given to the Atchleys by the neurologist was to go online and find other families affected by KIF 1A. Catherine says the doctor had never heard of the disorder before.
He was very upfront and honest and said, you know, I'm learning this as you guys learn it.
She found a Facebook support group for families with children who have KIF 1A-related disorder, and at the time, there were only 20 families in the group. It's since grown some as more kids get diagnosed through whole exome sequencing. Unfortunately, the test can be cost prohibitive for many, and not all insurance companies cover it. But Dr. Chung says more children being diagnosed will hopefully result in more researchers working to find a cure. Parents of kids with KIF 1A-related disorder, including Catherine Atchley, are working to raise awareness about the condition and money for research.
You know, in connecting with other families, I think there's a lot of us parents that I don't want to sit by and do nothing and just kind of let the medical community figure it out.
Dr. Chung has taken KIF 1A families under her wing and tells them she's their Sherpa, their guide through a frightening diagnosis up what she calls a large mountain as they try to seek treatment for their children. Currently, treatment is supportive and consists of things like physical therapy, getting seizures under control, and helping patients maintain their mobility. Dr. Chung calls herself an optimist and is hopeful a cure will be found one day, but she doesn't know if it will be 5, 10, or 20 years down the road. She says scientists are just beginning to understand KIF 1A-related disorder. After the diagnosis, Catherine says they began adjusting their hopes and dreams for their son. She couldn't look at Parker without crying.
One day I was sitting at the coffee table playing with them, and I'm just, he like trailed tears down my face. And I realized that it was really robbing us of our present with Parker.
Catherine, who calls herself an optimist in training, doesn't want to stand by and let the disease take away the progress Parker has made. She wants to do all she can to help find a cure.
I have to get people to care about Parker and the rest of these kids if they're going to have any hope of finding treatment or a cure.
Dr. Chung says funding is needed to support research on genetic disorders like KIF1A. You can find out more and donate at KIF1A.org. I'm Michelle Skaliski.
To hear the story again, visit KRCU.org. After the break, we've got stories from our community project, Dear Heartland.
Hi, I'm Ari Shapiro. Love what you hear on your car radio, but don't love your car anymore? Well, donate it to us. Your car can be turned into the programs you love. Here's how.
Visit KRCU.org and click on support for all the details.
We're back with Going Public on KRCU, and I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Today we're bringing you more from our community project, Dear Heartland, with a story from a woman named Charlie. She grew up in Claryville, Missouri during a time when millions of American soldiers were sent overseas to fight during World War II. And like many American families, hers was affected by it.
My cousins were older than I, and they were in the service. And it was scary because we did have a radio then that we could listen, a battery radio, that we could listen to the news when they talked about the war and the bombing. And we kids were scared to death. We would be outside playing, and from a long distance, we could hear the drone of airplanes. And it was huge, big airplanes that moved very slow. And we were scared to death, and we'd think, is that the enemy coming to bomb us? And we would all run under a tree and hope they couldn't see us under that tree until it went on over us. But they moved very slow. And then I remember the cousins that was in the service, and Mother wrote these funny looking, well, she wrote a letter, and then it was photographed to be sent to the boys. And I remember when they came back to Mother unclaimed, and they'd say they were missing in action. And Mother would continue writing them, and please get us a message. Your family wants to know, are you all right? We thought my one cousin had been killed in action. And a couple years later, they actually brought a body back and buried it. And then maybe 30 years later, on his mother's birthday, she had a telephone call, and back then when you had a long-distance call, the operator would say, long-distance calling from, and she couldn't remember. If she was so excited if it was New York or Pennsylvania, and this male voice said, happy birthday, Mom. And we've often wondered, did he play hooky? Did he play AWOL? Was he really killed in the... Who did they bury? And who called? Was it a spiritual thing, or was it really someone? Was it him? Was he in on the East Coast? Did he manage to, you know, there was a lot of people that would leave the war because they didn't want to fight. And he knew he couldn't come back home. They'd have got him. But those years were hard, you know.
That was Charlie from Claryville. Our next Dear Heartland comes from Judy Karen Collins in Perryville. Her father, Dr. Oscar Karen, was responsible for delivering about 6,000 babies in Perry County and other surrounding areas. To most people, he was just Doc or Uncle Doc, but to Judy, he was just Dad. She tells Dear Heartland about her dad's legacy in the community.
He was busy. It was, especially during the war years, the other doctors were called in, and he remained, and there were two older doctors to take care of this community. Town was about 5,000, and all the outlying areas, which we kind of referred to as all the suburbs. He worked 24/7. In those days, no appointments were made at the office. If you wanted to see a doctor, you came to the office and you waited your turn. And some people would even come to the house. If someone came to the house, we just automatically got out of the living room. And when television came in, that was a biggie because we had to leave and not finish hearing the end of the story to give the patient privacy. And the phone rang all the time, it seemed. My dad would be called out in the middle of the night, or one night he delivered four different babies, and so he was on the road traveling from one end of outside Perryville to another end, and timing who would deliver first and where he needed to be for the second baby. And so that night he was on the road all night. I often wondered how he ever got his proper rest, but one that always comes to my mind is two men came to town and they wanted Dad to ride with him out in the country to take care of their father. And my dad agreed to that. It was at nighttime, and they drove for so many miles way out in the country. And you know, he wondered, he doesn't know these two men. They were out-of-towners. And here he's got way out in the woods. He doesn't know really where he is. And they came to a dead end. And then they had to walk for a mile to get to this man's house. And as they kept walking and walking, he wondered, is he really being set up? And is he going to see the end of this night? And sure enough, they finally did get to their dad's house, and he needed attention. He had, if I recall, maggots on him, and in those days, maggots would eat up your soreness, your inflammation. And he took care of their father. And he thought, well, this will be another charity case, and maybe he will be paid by the two sons after they get back to town. But in the meantime, the gentleman that he was treating reached under his bed and he pulled out a wad of money and he paid my dad right there. So our life was rather hectic. He was a real devoted person, and I learned so much from him in his devotion to people, taking care of people. He taught me so much, even though there were times when we really didn't have enough time to spend with him. He dedicated his life to his profession. I'm just so proud, and I love to talk about him and to talk to other people who felt the same way. They loved him dearly. They gave him a Dr. Karen Day. The whole town celebrated years ago. It was back in about 1962, even before he retired. And the whole town celebrated. They all wore a sign that said, "I'm a Dr. Karen baby." And one time he was having surgery, and when he came to or before he went under, he looked around and he said, "I've delivered every one of you in this room.
the doctor, the nurses. There were at least 8 people standing around. And in the beginning, he used to take pictures of all these babies that he delivered. And I've given a lot of them back that I have run into over the years because I thought they would enjoy that.
That was Judy Karen Collins from Perryville. That's our show. To hear the stories from today's show, visit krcu.org or go to iTunes to hear this podcast. I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson. Join me Friday nights at 6 and Sundays at 3 for KRCU's Going Public.